possible so that they would think I had gone back into the room. But I hoped the fact that they had heard me crying would stand me in good stead. I waited until Jack had been gone for 3 hours before making my move. It was gone 11, but I knew the couple were still up because I could hear them moving around in their room. Mindful of what had happened the time before, I checked my bag, my case, and the room to make sure my passport and purse weren't there. When I couldn't find them, I went over to the door and opened it slowly, praying I wouldn't find Jack coming down the corridor on his way back. I didn't, but the thought that he might suddenly appear had me pounding on the Spanish couple's door more loudly than I intended. I could hear the man muttering something, annoyed perhaps at being disturbed so late at night.
¿Quién es?
He called through the closed door. I'm your neighbour. Could you help me, please?
¿Qué pasa?
Can you open the door, please? The unmistakable sound of the lift coming to a stop further down the corridor had me pounding on the door again. Hurry, I cried, my heart in my mouth. Please hurry! As the bolt was shot back, the noise of the lift doors opening propelled me into the room. Thank you, I gabbled. The words died on my lips, and I found myself staring in horror at Jack. I actually expected you before tonight, he said, laughing at the shock on my face. I was beginning to think I'd got you wrong. I'd almost begun to believe that you had heeded my warning after all and wouldn't attempt to escape. Of course, it would have been better for you if you had, but much less fun for me. I must admit, I would have been disappointed if all my hard work had gone to waste. My body went limp, and as I sank to the floor, shivering with shock, he crouched down next to me. Let me guess, he said softly. You thought a Spanish couple had moved into this room, didn't you? Yet there was only me. If you think about it, you never heard the woman reply because the voice came from a radio. You never saw her on the balcony either, yet you still believed that she existed. Of course, you didn't know that I smoked. I don't usually make a habit of it. Nor did you know that I spoke Spanish. He paused a moment. I also told you that it would be very foolish to try and escape again before we left Thailand, he went on, lowering his voice to a whisper. So now that you have, what do you think I'm going to do?
Do whatever you like, I sobbed. I don't care anymore.
Brave words, but I'm sure you don't mean them. For example, I'm sure you would be distraught if I decided to kill you, because it would mean you'd never see Millie again.
You're not going to kill me,
I said, with more assurance than I felt. You're right, I'm not. Not yet, anyway. First and foremost, I need you to do for Millie what she can't do for herself. He stood up and looked down at me dispassionately. Unfortunately, I can't punish you here because there is nothing I can really deprive you of. But because you have now tried to escape twice, we won't be going to see Millie either the first weekend or the second weekend after we get back to England.
You can't do that, I cried.
Of course I can. What's more, I warned you that I would. He reached down and hauled me to my feet. Come on, let's go. He opened the door and pushed me out into the corridor. It was well worth paying for the extra room, he said, closing the door behind him. Mr. Ho, the manager, quite understood why I might need a separate room for myself, given your mental state. How does it feel to know that I was watching you the whole time?
Not as good as it'll feel the day I see you go to prison, I snarled.
That, Grace, is never going to happen, he said, bundling me back into our room. And do you know why? Because I'm squeaky clean.
It was the lowest point of my 2 weeks in Thailand. It wasn't so much that I'd failed to escape. It was more that, once again, I'd fallen into the trap that Jack had so carefully laid for me.
I tried to work out why he had gone to such lengths to set me up when I wouldn't otherwise have tried to escape. Maybe it was simply that my acquiescence bored him. Or maybe it was something more sinister, in that by denying himself the pleasure of breaking me physically, he wanted the pleasure of breaking me mentally. The thought that he was going to turn my imprisonment into some sort of psychological game made my blood run cold. Even if another opportunity to escape presented itself, there would always be the fear that he was orchestrating the whole thing. And I realized that if I didn't get away from him as soon as we arrived in England, before we had even left the airport, it would be much, much harder once we were installed in a house. Battling despair, I forced myself to think about what I could do, both on the plane and when we arrived at Heathrow. If I told one of the air hostesses, once we had taken off, that Jack was keeping me prisoner, would I be able to remain calm when he maintained that I was delusional? What if he brought out the report from the hotel manager to back up his claim? What would I do then? And if I managed to remain calm and told them that he meant great harm to me and my sister, would I be able to persuade them to run checks on him while we were still in the air? And if they did, would they find that he was an imposter, or would they find that Jack Angel was a successful lawyer who championed battered women? I didn't know. But I was determined to make myself heard, and equally determined that if nobody listened, I would kick up such a fuss once we arrived at Heathrow that I would be taken to a hospital or a police station. I didn't think too much about it when I began to feel sleepy shortly after our evening flight had taken off. But by the time we landed the next morning, I was so groggy that a wheelchair had to be brought so that I could get off the plane, and my words were so slurred I could barely speak. Although I couldn't hear what Jack was saying to the doctor who came to check on me because of the fog that had permeated my brain, I could see that he was holding a bottle of pills in his hand. Aware that my chances of getting away from him were slipping through my fingers, I made a valiant effort to call for help as we were escorted through passport control, but all that came out of my mouth were unintelligible sounds. In the car, Jack strapped me into my seat, and I slumped against the door, unable to fight the drowsiness that rendered me helpless. The next time I came to, it was to find Jack force-feeding me strong black coffee he'd brought from a machine at a service station. It cleared my head a little, but I still felt confused and disorientated. "Where are we?" I slurred, making an effort to sit upright. "Nearly home," he replied, and there was such excitement in his voice that I felt afraid. He got me back in the car, and as we drove along, I tried to work out where we were, but I didn't recognize the names of any of the villages we passed. After about half an hour, he turned into a lane. "Well, here it is, my darling wife," he said, slowing the car down. "I hope you're going to like it." We stopped beside a pair of huge black gates. A little further along, there was a smaller single black gate with a bell set into the wall beside it. He took a remote control from his pocket, pressed a button, and the double gates swung open. "The house that I promised you as your wedding present. Now, what do you think of it?" At first, I thought that whatever he had drugged me with was making me hallucinate. But then I realized that I really was looking at the house we had drawn together, on a piece of paper, in the bar of the Connaught Hotel. The house he promised he would find for me, right down to the little round window in the roof. "I see that you're lost for words," he laughed as he drove in through the gates. After drawing to a stop near the front door, he got out of the car and came round to open my door for me. When I just sat there, he put his hands under my arms, hauled me unceremoniously from the car, and dragged me onto the porch. He unlocked the front door and pushed me into the hall, slamming the door behind him. "Welcome home," he said mockingly. "I hope you'll be very happy here." The hall was beautiful, with its high ceiling, and magnificent staircase. The doors to the right were closed, as were the huge double doors to the left. "I'm sure you'd like me to show you around," he went on. "But first, wouldn't you like to see Molly?" I stared at him. "Molly?" "Yes, Molly. Don't tell me you'd forgotten all about her." "Where is she?" I asked urgently, shocked that I hadn't thought about her once while we'd been in Thailand. "Where's Molly?" "In the utility room." He opened a door to the right of the staircase and switched on a light. "Down here." As I followed him down to the basement, I recognised the tiles from the photo he had shown me of Molly in her basket. He came to a stop in front of a door. "She's in there. But before you go and see her, you'd better take one of these." He took a roll of bin bags from where they were lying on a shelf, tore one off, and handed it to me. "I think you might be needing it." Present. Even though the days pass slowly for me, I'm always amazed at how quickly Sundays come round. Today, though, I can't help feeling depressed, because there is no visit to Millie to look forward to. I don't know this for sure, but it's unlikely that Jack will take me to see her when we've been for the last two Sundays. Still, it could be that he'll surprise me, so I've had my shower just in case, drying both myself and my hair on the small hand towel that he allows me. Bath sheets and hair dryers are luxuries of a past long gone, as are visits to the hairdressers. Although drying myself is a misery in the winter, it's not all that bad. My hair, denied both heat and scissors, is long and shiny, and with a bit of ingenuity, I can manage to tie it in a knot so that it doesn't annoy me. It wasn't always so bad. When we first arrived in the house, I had a much nicer bedroom, with all sorts of things to keep me amused, which Jack deprived me of with each attempt to escape. First the kettle went, then the radio, then the books. With nothing to distract me, I resorted to relieving the stultifying boredom of the days by playing around with the clothes in my wardrobe, mixing and matching different outfits just for the hell of it. But after another failed attempt to escape, Jack took me from that room and installed me in the box room next door, which he'd stripped of every comfort, except for the bed. He even went to the trouble of adding bars to the windows. Deprived of my wardrobe, it meant that I had to rely on him to bring me my clothes each morning. I soon forfeited that right, too. And now, unless we're going out, I'm made to wear pyjamas, day and night. Although he brings me clean ones 3 times a week, there is nothing to relieve the monotony of wearing the same thing, day in, day out, especially when each pair is exactly the same as the last. They are all the same style and all the same colour, black, with nothing to distinguish one pair from another. Once, not very long ago, when I asked him if I could have a dress to wear during the day for a change, he brought me a curtain I'd had in my flat and told me to make one for myself. He thought himself funny because he knew I had no scissors or needle and thread, but when he found me wearing it the next day, wrapped around me like a sarong and a welcome change from pyjamas, he took it away again, annoyed by my ingenuity. Hence his little joke to Esther and the others about me being something of a seamstress and making my own clothes. He loves to put me on the spot, to see how I'll cope with something he's thrown nonchalantly into the conversation, hoping I'll mess it up so he can punish me. But I'm getting quite good at making it up as I go along. Personally, I'm hoping Esther and the others will ask me again about starting a sewing circle, because it'll be Jack who'll have to get me out of that one. Perhaps he'll start by breaking my arm or mangling my fingers in a door. So far, he has never harmed me physically, although there are times when I think that he'd like to. Sometime in the afternoon, I hear a ring at the gate, so I jump off the bed and press my ear to the door. It's the first bit of excitement I've had in a long time, as people never drop in uninvited. I wait to hear if Jack is going to let in whoever it is, or at least inquire what they want. But when the house remains silent, I know he's pretending that we're not at home. Fortunately for him, it's impossible to see the car parked in the driveway through the black gates. When whoever it is rings again, this time more impatiently, my thoughts turn immediately to Esther. I've been thinking about her a lot lately, mainly because of the way she repeated her mobile number in the restaurant last week. The more I think about it, the more I'm convinced she understood that I needed to hear it again. And I know that if there ever comes a time when I need to ask for help, it will be Esther I'll turn to rather than Diane, who I've known for longer. I've lost all my own friends, even Kate and Emily, who I thought would always stand by me. But my irregular and very short emails to them, dictated by Jack, where I trilled about how wonderful married life was and said I was too busy to see them, ensured that theirs dried up quickly. I didn't even get a birthday card from them this year. Now that he's got rid of my friends, Jack allows me to reply to other emails addressed specifically to me, from my parents or Diane, for example, rather than reply to them himself, but only to give them a more genuine flavour, although I'm not sure how genuine I managed to make them sound with him breathing down my neck as I write. On these occasions, I'm brought down to his study, and I welcome these moments where, with both a computer and a telephone within reach, the potential of alerting someone is greater than anywhere else. My heart always starts beating faster as Jack sits me down, with the computer and telephone only inches away, because there's always the hope that he might be distracted long enough for me to be able to snatch up the phone, dial a quick 999 and scream my despair to the police, or pound a quick plea for help on the keyboard to whoever I'm writing to and press the send button before he can stop me. The temptation to do so is great, but Jack is always vigilant. He stands over me as I write and checks each message before he allows me to send it. Once I thought my chance had come when somebody rang at the gate as I was writing, but instead of going to the intercom to see who was there, Jack simply ignored it, as he does the telephone when it rings while I'm seated at the computer. Yet along with the frustration I feel when he escorts me back to my room, at another chance gone, there is also a feeling of near contentment, especially after I've written to my parents. It's almost as if I believe the lies I've told them, about weekends away that Jack and I have been on, or visits to beautiful gardens, to country houses, to places I've never been and where I will never go, yet am able to describe in such detail. But as with all highs, the coming down is hard, and once the euphoria has gone, I feel more depressed than ever. There's no third ring at the gate, so I go back to the bed and lie down. I feel so restless that I decide to try a bit of meditation to relax me. I taught myself to meditate not long after Jack moved me into this room, for fear I would go mad with nothing to do all day. I've become so good at it that sometimes I manage to drift off for what often seems like several hours, but it's probably a lot less. I usually start by picturing Millie and me sitting in a beautiful garden with a little dog at our feet. Not Molly, though. To be able to lose myself, I need to think happy thoughts. Today, however, I'm unable to relax because the only picture I can bring to my mind is that of Esther driving away from the house. In my isolation, I've become superstitious, and I take it as a sign that I've got it all wrong, that Esther isn't going to be the one to help me. When I hear Jack coming up the stairs, maybe an hour or so after the ring at the gate, I try to guess if he's come to play some sort of game with me, or if he's simply bringing me a late lunch. He unlocks the door. There's no tray in his hand, So I prepare myself for one of his sadistic games, especially when I see that he's holding a book. The urge to pounce on it and snatch it out of his hand is powerful, but I keep my face impassive and do my best not to look at it, wondering what torment he's devised this time. He knows how I crave to have something to read. I've lost count of the number of times I've pleaded with him to let me have a newspaper, just once a week even, to help me keep up to date with what's happening in the world, so that I don't appear a complete idiot when we go out to dinner. So I'm fully expecting him to offer me the book, only to withdraw his hand the moment I reach out to take it. "I have something for you," he begins. "What?" I ask, as unenthusiastically as I can. "A book." He pauses. "Would you like it?" Coming from Jack, it's the question I hate most in the world, as I'm damned if I say yes and damned if I say no. "It depends," I say, hating that I'm prolonging my agony by trying to keep him there as long as possible, because at least he's someone to talk to. "On what?" "Its title. If it's called My Life with a Psychopath, I'm not interested." He smiles. "Actually, it's the one that Esther recommended." "And you decided to buy it for me?" "No, she dropped it off." He pauses again. "Under normal circumstances, I would have put it straight in the bin. But it came with a very charming invitation to dinner a week next Saturday, with a little postscriptum saying that she can't wait to hear what you think of the book. So I suggest you make sure you've read it by then." "I'm not sure I'll have time, but I'll do my best," I tell him. "Don't get too smart," he warns. "You've become so adept at avoiding punishment that I only need the slightest excuse." He leaves, and, unable to wait any longer, I open the book and read the first page to get an idea of what it's about. I know instantly that I'm going to love it, and I hate the thought that it'll only take me a day or so to read it. I wonder if I should wait a while before starting it properly, and limit myself to a chapter a day. But because there's always the possibility that Jack will take it back again before I've had the chance to finish it, I settle down on my bed, ready to spend the best few hours I've had for a long time. I've been reading for about an hour when I notice that one of the words I've just read, the word "all right," stands out more than the others, and when I look closely, I see that it's been lightly shaded in pencil. Something about it jogs my memory, and going back a few pages, I find the word "thing" highlighted in the same manner, but so lightly, I'm not convinced I would have noticed had I not been looking for it. I flip back a few more pages and come across the word "every," which I recognise as the word that had caught my attention earlier, although I had put its darker background down to a printing problem. Intrigued, I carry on turning back the pages and eventually find a tiny "is" nearer the beginning of the book. I run it together. "Is everything all right?" My heart starts beating faster as I consider the possibility that Esther has sent me a message. If she has, there has to be more. With a mounting sense of excitement, I scan the rest of the book for evidence of shading and find "do you need," and on the second to last page of the book, "help." The elation I feel that she has recognised my predicament and wants to help is short-lived, because how can I reply to Esther when I don't have access to something as mundane as a pencil? Even if I had one, I'd be at a loss as to what to reply. A mere "yes" wouldn't be enough. A "yes, get the police" would be futile because, as I know to my cost, Jack has them in his pocket. Like the staff at the hotel in Thailand, they know me as a manic depressive, given to accusing my devoted and brilliant lawyer husband of keeping me prisoner. Even if they arrived at the house without warning, Jack would have no trouble explaining away this room or any other room in the house for that matter. Anyway, he would never let me return the book to Esther without checking it first, just as he always checks my bag before we go out to make sure it's empty. It suddenly occurs to me that he wouldn't have let me look in the book in the first place if he hadn't gone through it thoroughly, which means he's almost certainly seen the shading. It's an appalling thought, not least because Esther could be in danger from him. It also means I'll have to be careful what I say to her when we next meet, as knowing that I can't get a message back to her in kind, Jack will be listening to every word I say. He'll probably be expecting me to say something along the lines of, "I thought the message the author was trying to get across was quite pertinent," but he's going to be disappointed. I might have been that stupid once, but not anymore. It might be difficult to get a message back to Esther, but I refuse to feel downhearted. I'm so grateful that she has understood so quickly what nobody else ever has. Not my parents, or Diane, or Janice, or the police. That Jack controls everything I do. I find myself frowning, because if she suspects that he controls me, surely she must guess that he also controls everything I come into contact with. If she's realised that Jack is not someone to be trifled with, why would she risk discovery when she has nothing concrete to back up her suspicions? I go back to reading, hoping to find something that will tell me how I can communicate with Esther without Jack finding out, because how can I let her down when she has reached out to me so amazingly? Sometime in the evening, when I'm still trying to work out a way of getting a message back to her, I hear Jack coming up the stairs, so I close the book quickly and place it a little way from me on the bed. "Finished already?" he remarks, nodding at the book. "Actually, I'm finding it hard to get into," I lie. "It's not the sort of thing I'd normally read."
"How far have you got with it?"
"Not very far."
"Well, make sure you finish it before we see her next week."
He leaves, and I find myself frowning again. It's the second time he's insisted that I read it before we go to Esther's for dinner, which tells me that he knows about the shading and is hoping I'm going to dig a grave for myself. After all, he as good as admitted, when he said earlier that I was getting too clever for my own good, that he misses punishing me. So I can imagine how happy he must have been to see Esther's message, and how he must have laughed at her attempt to help me. But then, the more I think about it, the more I feel that I've missed something. It's only when I remember the amount of time that passed between the ring on the doorbell and Jack bringing the book up to me that it dawns on me that the shading in the book is not Esther's work, but Jack's. Past. Molly could only have been dead a few days at the most, because her body hadn't started to decompose. Jack had been very clever in that respect. He had left her some water, but not quite enough to last her the 2 weeks until we got home. The shock of finding her dead was terrible. The look of malevolent anticipation on Jack's face as he opened the door to the utility room had prepared me for something. That he had left her tied up for the 2 weeks we were away, or that she wouldn't be there, but not that he had left her to die. At first, as I looked down at her little body lying on the floor, I thought the drugs he had given me were playing with my mind because I was still feeling woozy. But when I knelt down beside her and found her body cold and rigid, I thought about the terrible death she must have endured. It was then that I didn't only vow to kill Jack, but to make him suffer, as he had made Molly suffer. He feigned surprise at my distress, reminding me that he had told me in Thailand there was no housekeeper, and I was grateful I hadn't paid any attention to what he'd said back then. If I'd understood what he was alluding to, I don't know how I would have got through those 2 weeks. "I'm so glad that you loved her," he said as I knelt beside Molly and wept. "I hoped you would. It's important, you see, that you realise just how much harder it would be if it were Millie lying there rather than Molly. And if Millie were dead, you'd have to take her place. When you think about it, nobody would really miss you, and
If anybody asked where you were, I'd say that following the death of your beloved sister, you had decided to join your parents in New Zealand.
Why can't I replace Millie anyway?
I sobbed.
Why do you need her?
Because she will be so much easier to terrify than you. Besides, if I have Millie, I'll have everything I need right here, and I won't have to go to Thailand anymore.
I don't understand.
I dashed tears from my cheeks with the back of my hand.
Don't you go to Thailand to have sex with men?
Sex with men? He seemed amused by the idea. I could do that here if I chose to. Not that I would choose to. You see, I'm not interested in sex. The reason I go to Thailand is so that I can indulge my greatest passion. Not that I actually get my hands dirty, you understand. No, my role is more that of observer and listener. I stared up at him uncomprehendingly, and he bent his head towards mine. Fear, he whispered. There is nothing quite like it. I love how it looks. I love how it feels. I love how it smells. And I especially love the sound of it. I felt his tongue on my cheek. I even love the taste of it.
You disgust me, I hissed. You must be one of the most evil people that has ever lived. And I'll get you, Jack. I promise. In the end, I'll get you.
Not if I get Millie first, which I intend to do.
So you're going to kill her?
I said, my voice breaking. Kill her? What use would she be to me dead? I'm not going to kill Millie, Grace. I'm just going to scare her a little. Now, do you want to bury that dog, or shall I dump it in the bin? He didn't lift a finger to help, but stood and watched as I wrapped Molly's body in the black bin bag and, sobbing with distress, carried her up the stairs, through the kitchen, and out onto the terrace that I had told him I wanted. I looked around the vast garden, shivering with cold and shock, wondering where I could put her. Following me out, he pointed to a hedge at the bottom of the garden and told me to bury her behind it. As I rounded it, I saw a shovel standing ready in the ground, and the knowledge that before leaving Molly to die, he had prepared a shovel for me to bury her with made me break into fresh sobs. It had rained while we were in Thailand, so the ground was soft, but digging her grave was only made bearable by imagining it was his I was preparing. When I had finished, I took Molly's body out of the bin bag and held her to me for a moment, thinking of Millie, wondering how I was going to be able to tell her that Molly was dead. She's not going to come back to life, no matter how long you hold her for, he drawled. Just get on with it. Afraid that he would snatch her from me and throw her unceremoniously into the hole I had dug, I placed her gently in it and shoveled the earth back on top. It was then that the full horror of what had just happened hit me, and throwing the shovel down, I dashed behind a tree and was violently sick. You're going to have to learn to have a stronger stomach than that, he remarked as I wiped my mouth on the back of my hand. His words sent waves of panic shooting through me. Running back to where I'd dropped the shovel, I snatched it up and rushed towards him with it raised high above my head, ready to bring it down on him and beat him to a pulp. But I was no match for him. Raising his arm, he caught hold of the shovel and wrestled it from me, causing me to stumble. Righting myself, I broke into a run, screaming for help at the top of my voice. When I saw that the windows of the nearest property were only just visible through the trees, I ran towards it, hoping that someone would have heard my screams, and as I ran, I looked for a way out of the garden. Realizing that the walls that bordered it were too high for me to climb, I drew in air, about to scream again for all I was worth, knowing it might be my only chance. A blow to my back expelled the air I had drawn in with little more than a grunt, and as I fell forward, Jack's hand came around my mouth, silencing me completely. Jerking me upright, he used his other hand to bend my arm behind my back, rendering me helpless. "I take it you're not in a hurry to see Millie again," he breathed as he frog-marched me back towards the house. "Because of your attempts to escape in Thailand, you had already forfeited your right to see her for the next 2 weekends. Now you won't see her for a third weekend running. And if you try anything again, you won't see her for a whole month." I struggled against him, twisting my head away from him in a frantic effort to free my mouth from his hand, but he simply tightened his grip on me. "Poor Millie," he sighed in mock sorrow as he propelled me along the terrace and into the kitchen. "She's going to think you've abandoned her, that now you're married, you have no time for her." Releasing me, he pushed me away from him. "Listen to me, Grace. Provided you don't do anything stupid, I am prepared to treat you well. After all, it's not in my interest to do otherwise. Nevertheless, I shan't hesitate to withdraw any of the privileges I have chosen to accord you should you displease me. Do you understand?" Slumped against the wall, trembling with fatigue, or from the after effects of the drugs, or from shock, I could only nod mutely. "Good. Now, before I show you the rest of the house, I'm sure you'd like a shower." Pathetic tears of gratitude sprang to my eyes. "I'm not a monster," he said with a frown, noticing. "Well, at least not in that sense. Come on, I'll show you where the bathroom is, and once you feel more refreshed, I'll give you a tour of the house." I followed him into the hall and up the stairs, barely noticing my surroundings. Opening a door, he showed me into a bright and airy bedroom decorated in pale greens and cream. On the double bed, I recognised some of the coverings and cushions I had chosen the day we had gone shopping together to buy furniture for the house he had promised to find me. In the hostile world I found myself in, they seemed like old familiar friends, and my spirits lifted a little. "Do you like it?" he asked. "Yes," I said reluctantly. "Good." He seemed pleased. "The bathroom's through there, and you'll find your clothes in the wardrobe." He looked at his watch. "I'll give you 15 minutes. The door closed behind him. Curious, I walked over to the huge wardrobe that ran the length of the left-hand wall. Sliding the doors open, I found the clothes that I had sent to the house ahead of me, the ones I hadn't needed to take to Thailand, hanging there. My T-shirts and jumpers were neatly folded on the shelves, and my underwear had been put in specially made drawers. In another part of the wardrobe, my many pairs of shoes had been placed in clear plastic boxes. Everything seemed so normal that once again I experienced a feeling of disconnect. It was impossible to equate the beautiful room Jack had prepared for me and the promise of a shower with what had gone before. And I couldn't rid myself of the feeling that if I were to lie down on the bed and sleep for a while, I would wake up to find it had all been a terrible nightmare. I went over to the window and looked out. It gave onto the side of the house, where a rose garden had been planted. Just as I was appreciating the beauty of the flowers and the stillness of the afternoon, a black bin bag, caught in a sudden gust of wind, came scudding around from the back of the house and became snagged in one of the rose bushes. Recognizing it as the one I had carried Molly out to the garden in, I gave a cry of distress, turned from the window, and hurried over to the door, realizing I had wasted precious minutes when I should have been trying to escape. Yanking it open, I was about to run out into the hall when Jack's arm came shooting out, blocking my way. "Going somewhere?" he asked pleasantly. I stared at him, my heart thumping painfully in my chest. "You wouldn't have been thinking of trying to leave, would you?" I thought of Millie, about how upset she would be by my non-appearance over the next 3 weeks, and knew I couldn't risk another punishment.
Towels, I mumbled. I was wondering where the towels were.
If you looked in the bathroom, you would have found them. Hurry up. You only have 10 minutes left. As he closed the door on me, imprisoning me again, I went over to the bathroom. It had a walk-in shower and separate bath, as well as a sink and toilet. There was a large pile of fluffy towels on top of a low cupboard, and on opening it, I saw it was generously stacked with bottles of shampoo, conditioner, and shower gel. Suddenly desperate to wash away the filth that seemed to permeate from every pore of my body, I stripped off, turned on the shower, and, arming myself with everything I would need, stepped under the water. I adjusted the temperature to the hottest I could bear, shampooed my hair, and scrubbed away at my body, wondering if I would ever feel clean again. I would have stayed longer under the water, but I didn't trust Jack not to come in and pull me out of the shower as soon as 10 minutes were up, so I turned off the tap and dried myself quickly. In the cupboard under the sink, I found a pack of toothbrushes and some toothpaste, and used a precious 2 minutes of the time I had left brushing my teeth until my gums bled. I hurried through to the bedroom, opened the wardrobe, pulled a dress off one of the hangers, took a bra and pair of knickers from a drawer and dressed quickly. The bedroom door opened as I was zipping up my dress.
Good, he said. I didn't particularly want to have to come and drag you out of the shower.
But I would have. He nodded towards the wardrobe. Put something on your feet. After a slight hesitation, I chose a pair of shoes with a small heel rather than the slippers my feet ached for, hoping they would make me feel more in control.
Now for the tour of the house. I hope you're going to like it.
I followed him down the stairs, wondering why he should care whether I liked it or not. Although I was determined not to be impressed, reason told me that giving him the positive reaction he obviously craved might be in my interest.
It's taken me 2 years to get the house exactly as I wanted it, he remarked as we reached the hall, especially as I had to make last-minute changes that I hadn't accounted for. For example, the kitchen originally didn't lead onto a terrace, but I had one built because I thought it was an excellent idea. Fortunately, I managed to steer the rest of your desires towards what was already here, he went on, confirming what I had already worked out, that the day he had asked me to describe the sort of house I would like, he had cleverly manoeuvred me into describing one he had already bought. If you remember, you said you wanted a toilet on the ground floor for guests to use, but when I suggested a whole cloakroom, you readily agreed. Opening a door on the right, he revealed a cloakroom that housed a wardrobe, large mirror, and a separate washroom. Very clever, I said, referring to the way he had manipulated me. Yes, was rather, he agreed.
Moving on down the hall, he opened the next door along,
my study and library.
I caught a quick glimpse of a room covered from floor to ceiling with book-lined shelves and, in an alcove to the right, a mahogany desk.
It's not a room you'll have to come into very often.
Crossing over to the other side of the hall, he threw open the huge double doors that I'd noticed earlier.
The sitting room and dining room.
He held the doors open, inviting me to go in, and I stepped into one of the most beautiful rooms I'd ever seen. But I barely noticed the 4 sets of French windows that gave onto the rose garden at the side of the house, or the high ceilings, or the elegant archway that led through to the dining room, because my eyes were immediately drawn to the fireplace, where Fireflies, the painting I had done for Jack, was hanging.
It looks quite perfect there, don't you think? He said.
Remembering the love and effort I had put into it, and the fact that it was composed of hundreds of kisses, I felt sick to my stomach. Turning abruptly on my heels, I went back out into the hall.
I hope that doesn't mean you don't like the room, he frowned, following me out.
Why should you care whether or not I like it? I snarled.
I have nothing against you personally, Grace, he said patiently as he continued down the hall. As I explained in Thailand, you are the means to the end I have always dreamed of having, so it's normal that I feel some sort of gratitude towards you. Therefore, I would like your experience here to be as pleasant as possible, at least until Millie arrives. Once she does, I'm afraid it will be extremely unpleasant for you, and for her, of course. Now, you didn't get a chance to see the kitchen properly yesterday, did you? He opened the kitchen door, and I saw the breakfast bar that we had decided we'd have, complete with 4 high, shiny stools. Oh, Millie will love those, I cried, imagining her turning herself around on them. In the silence that followed, everything that had happened caught up with me, and the room began to spin so fast that I felt myself falling. Aware of Jack's arms reaching out to catch me, I made a feeble attempt to fight him off before passing out. When I next opened my eyes, I felt so wonderfully rested, my first thought was that I was on holiday somewhere. Looking around, still drowsy with sleep, I saw all the equipment necessary to make tea and coffee on a table near the bed and decided I was in a hotel, but where I didn't know. As I took in the pale green walls that were both familiar and unfamiliar, I suddenly remembered where I was. Leaping from the bed, I ran to the door and tried to open it. When I found that I was locked in, I began hammering on it, screaming at Jack to let me out. The key turned on the lock and the door opened. For goodness sake, Grace, he said, clearly annoyed. You only had to call me. How dare you lock me in? I cried, my voice trembling with rage. I locked you in for your own good. If I hadn't, you might have been foolish enough to try and escape again, and I would have had to deprive you of yet another visit to Millie. He turned and reached for a tray which lay on a small table outside my door. Now, if you move back a little, I'll give you something to eat. The thought of food was tempting. I couldn't remember the last time I'd eaten, but it must have been well before leaving Thailand. But the open door was even more tempting. Moving aside, but not back as he had asked, I waited until he had come right into the room, then lunged towards him, knocking the tray from his hands. Amid the sound of breaking crockery and his roar of rage, I ran towards the stairs and went down them 2 at a time, registering too late that the hall below was in complete darkness. Arriving at the bottom of the stairs, I searched for a light switch and, finding none, felt along the wall until I arrived at the kitchen door. Throwing it open, I found that it too was in darkness. Remembering the 4 sets of French windows I'd seen in the sitting room the day before, I crossed the hall and groped along the wall until I found the double doors. The total darkness inside the room, without even a glimmer of light coming in from the windows, as well as the silence, because the house was eerily quiet, became suddenly terrifying. The knowledge that Jack could be anywhere, that he could have crept down the stairs behind me and be standing within feet of me, made my heart race with fear. Stepping into the room, I slid to the floor behind one of the doors, drew my knees up around my chest, and curled myself into a ball, expecting his hands to reach down and grab me at any moment. The suspense was terrible, and the thought that he might decide not to find me until it suited him made me regret ever having left the relative safety of the bedroom. "Where are you, Grace?" His voice came from somewhere out in the hall, and his soft, sing-song tone only added to my terror. In the silence, I heard him sniffing the air. I do so love the smell of fear, he breathed. His feet padded across the hall, and when they got nearer, I shrank back against the wall. They stopped, and as I strained my ears, trying to work out where he was, I felt his breath on my cheek. "Boo," he whispered. As I burst into tears of relief that my ordeal was over, he roared with laughter. A whirring sound heralded the beginnings of daylight filtering into the room, and raising my head, I saw Jack holding a remote control in his hand. "Steel shutters," he explained. "Every window on the ground floor has been fitted with them. Even if you happen, by some miracle, to find a way out of your room when I'm at work, you certainly won't find a way out of the house."
"Let me go, Jack," I begged. "Please, just let me go."
"Why would I do that? In fact, I think I'm going to enjoy having you here, especially if you continue trying to escape. At least you'll keep me amused until Millie comes to live with us." He paused. "You know, I was almost beginning to regret not arranging for her to move in as soon as we came back from our honeymoon. Just think, she could have been arriving at any moment." I draw in my breath sharply. "Do you really think I'm going to let Millie come anywhere near this house?" I cried. "Or you anywhere near her?"
"I seem to remember having this conversation with you in Thailand," he said, sounding bored. "The sooner you accept that the wheels are already in motion and that there is nothing you can do to stop them, the better it will be for you. There is no escape. You're mine now."
"I can't believe you think you're going to get away with it. You can't keep me hidden away forever, you know. What about my friends, our friends? Aren't we meant to be having dinner with Moira and Giles when we return the car to them?"
"I shall tell them exactly what I intend to tell Millie's school. It will now be 4 weeks until you see her, by the way. Which is that you picked up a nasty bug in Thailand and are indisposed. And when I do eventually allow you to see Millie again, I will watch your every move and listen to every word. Should you try to inform anyone of what is going on, you and Millie will both pay. As for your friends, well, you're not really going to have time for them now that you're so happily married, and when you no longer reply to their emails, they'll forget all about you. It will be a gradual thing, of course. I'll let you maintain contact for a while, but I'll vet your emails before you send them, just in case you try to alert anyone to your situation." He paused. "But I can't imagine you would be so foolish." Until that point, I had never doubted that I would be able to escape from him, or at least tell someone that I was being held prisoner. But there was something about the matter-of-fact way he spoke that was chilling. His absolute certainty that everything would pan out exactly as he had planned made me, for the first time, doubt my ability to outwit him. As he escorted me back to my bedroom, telling me that I would get no food until the following day, all I could think about was what he had done to Molly and what he would do to me if I tried to get away from him again. I couldn't afford to risk not seeing Millie for yet another week, and the thought of her disappointment when I didn't turn up for the next few Sundays made me feel even more wretched than I already felt. It was the hunger pains I was experiencing that gave me the idea of pretending I had appendicitis so that Jack would have no choice but to take me to hospital, where I felt I'd be able to get someone to listen to me. When he eventually brought me food the next day, as he promised he would, it was already late evening, so I hadn't had anything to eat for over 48 hours. It was hard not to eat much of what he'd brought me, and as I clutched my stomach and moaned that it hurt, I was grateful for the cramps that made my pain more genuine. Unfortunately, Jack remained unmoved, but when he found me doubled up the next morning, he agreed to bring me the aspirin that I asked for, although he made me swallow it in front of him. By the evening, I'd progressed to writhing around on the bed, and during the night, I hammered on the door until he came to see what all the noise was about. Telling him that I was in agony, I asked him to call an ambulance. He refused, saying that if I was still in pain the next day, he would call a doctor. It wasn't the result I'd wanted, but it was better than nothing,
and I planned carefully what I would say to the doctor when he came, knowing, after my experience in Thailand, that I couldn't afford to sound hysterical. I hadn't foreseen that Jack would stay with me while the doctor examined me, and as I acted out being in pain every time he probed my stomach, my mind raced frantically ahead, aware that if I didn't seize the moment, all my play-acting and depriving myself of food would have been for nothing. When I asked the doctor if I could speak to him alone, insinuating that the pain I was experiencing might be due to gynecological problems, I felt victorious when he asked Jack if he would mind stepping out of the room. After, I wondered why it hadn't occurred to me that Jack's willingness to leave the room meant that he wasn't worried about the outcome of my tête-à-tête with the doctor. Neither did the doctor's sympathetic smile, as I told him urgently that I was being held prisoner, make me suspicious. It was only when he began questioning me about what he called my suicide attempt and a supposed history of depression that I understood Jack had covered all angles before the doctor had even set foot in my bedroom. Appalled, I begged him to believe that Jack wasn't who he said he was and repeated what he had told me, that he had beaten his mother to death when he was little more than a child and had let his father take the blame. But even while I was speaking, I could hear how unbelievable it sounded, and as he wrote out a prescription for Prozac, I became so hysterical that it gave weight to what Jack had told him, that I was an attention-seeking, manic depressive. He even had the paperwork to prove it, a copy of my medical reports from the time of my overdose, and a letter from the manager of the hotel in Thailand detailing my behaviour the night we arrived. Devastated by my failure to convince the doctor that I was speaking the truth, the enormity of the task before me seemed once again insurmountable. If I couldn't persuade a professional to consider what I had told him, how was I going to be able to get anyone else to understand what was going on? Even more pertinent, how was I ever going to be able to talk to anyone freely when Jack wouldn't allow me any communication with the outside world unless it was controlled by him? He began to monitor the emails I received, and if he didn't dictate my reply word for word, he stood over me and read every word I wrote. As I was locked in my room day and night, people were forced to leave a message on the answer phone, unless Jack was around to take their calls. If they asked to speak to me personally, he would tell them that I was in the shower or out shopping and would call them back. And if he did allow me to call them back, he would listen to what I said. But I didn't dare object, as my conversation with the doctor had cost me another week's visit to Millie, as well as the right to have tea and coffee in my room. I knew that if I wanted to see her again in the near future, I'd have to behave exactly as Jack wanted, at least for a while. So I submitted, without complaint, to the restraints he placed on me. When he came to bring me food, he brought it morning and evening back then, I made sure he found me